Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Sarah Carr, author of Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. We'll also talk with Daniel Brook, author of The History of Future Cities, and Veronica Cavas, author of Artist in Love, From Picasso and Gillot to Christo and Jean-Claude, A Century of Creative and Romantic Partnerships. New Orleans writer Sarah Carr has been covering the education beat for more than 12 years, writing for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and until very recently, the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Her new book, Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children, describes a year in the life of a student and her family, a new teacher, and a seasoned principal as they move forward in the post-Katrina educational environment of New Orleans. Sarah, it's a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, you cover a lot of material in Hope Against Hope, and you do it in a really economical fashion. Three schools, three individuals in very different roles. How did you make those choices?
I think that's a great question. It would have been a more compact and neat narrative in some ways if I had just focused on one school. But the school landscape in New Orleans is so varied and so complicated that I didn't think I could write about it in the depth that I wanted to, telling it just through the lens of one school. If I had just written about Kip Renaissance or just written about Old Prairie Walker or just written about Psi Academy, I think it would have been a very, very different book and could potentially have offered a somewhat narrow or distorted view of the school landscape here. So I settled on the idea of three schools initially, and then the decision to feature a principal, a teacher, and a family sort of arose organically after that, and mainly from the fact that I wanted to tell the story through people who had different perspectives, different experiences in the schools, and in very different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. They let you in. They totally let you into their lives, every part of their lives, it seems.
Yeah, no, I think it took a lot of courage for the families and for the schools, but I admired their openness quite a bit and the bravery that they showed in not only kind of highlighting the good points and the successes that they had, but also really being open to letting me see their challenges and some of their warts. You know, I found schools in New Orleans to be very open throughout my time here, and I don't think that's always the case in other cities, and I think it's a testament to the educators working here that they are open.
Right. Now, one of the things that I love about this book is that you say in the very beginning that this book, it focuses on what makes New Orleans ordinary rather than extraordinary.
Yeah, as a resident here, it's been a frustration for me. The way so much of the literature about New Orleans, and I'm thinking of kind of literature in a very broad sense, focuses on the extremes. And sometimes it focuses on the good extremes, and New Orleans's rich culture and Mardi Gras and music, and sometimes on the bad extremes like Katrina. And I don't think you can ignore those aspects of the city. And I think sometimes that kind of focus can be helpful, but other times I feel like it does a disservice to the city and sort of, I guess without denying that New Orleans is special in a lot of ways, I wanted to write about the ways in which the challenges that New Orleans faces really are the challenges of urban America, just sort of heightened at times here.
And some of these things are so universal and so emotional. There's this moment when Raquel Dillon, who is the mother in the family of the student that mm-hmm. you cover, Gerald Lynn, mm-hmm. tells her daughter, "Don't be like me, be a little better." Mm-hmm. And that's one of those heartbreaking moments that I think every parent really feels.
Yeah, no, and Raquel is such a wonderful person who does so much that, you know, I mean, she has so much to be proud of. But I think that's a very natural desire for any parent mm-hmm. to want to see their child in a somewhat more secure situation, particularly since she has to, I mean, she works 60 to 80 hours a week to pay the bills and to keep her family going. And so I think she wants her daughters to be able to spend more time with their children.
Now, Psi, the New Orleans Charter Science and Math Academy, is a very specific culture, and that's a lot of what your book is about. It's about the culture of schools. So I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about what you think makes up a culture.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, I didn't set out to write a book about school culture. And I think as I reported and wrote the book, that just sort of emerged as one of the connecting themes and one of the things I kept noticing and that fascinated me the most. And I think that was partly because the schools that I spent time in had such different and distinct cultures. And I also just saw very vivid examples of ways in which a school's culture could at times both attract kids and keep them coming to school and at times repel kids. So it really isn't a book about school politics or about pedagogy or curriculum. I think it's sort of about different and at times competing visions for what a school should be like, and that you see over the course of it the incredible success schools can have when parents and staff and kids come together around a vision, and the problems when they don't.
Right. You find just the right atmosphere for learning. You don't want to let it go. It's just,
exactly.
It's a lucky thing. Now, this book gives a microcosm as well as a macrocosm of so many things that contribute to our difficulties with education: poverty, limited opportunity, violence in the streets. And all too often when we tell the story of schools, there's a terrible tragedy involved. There's a mother's grief, a son's loss. And I know you ran up against that in some of the stories you were reporting here.
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw both sort of reason for optimism in that schools alone can do a lot and can really help be forces for transforming society. But schools alone and good education alone isn't enough when you have kids who are sort of grappling with homelessness and with gun violence in their communities and with sort of all of these out of school forces. And one of the schools I wrote about, O'Perry Walker, over the course of that year, they saw a young alum named Boogie Massey who was murdered. And just those kinds of tragedies really affect an entire school community and all the families connected with that school, and can really cause learning to come to a halt temporarily for very natural reasons, because people are grieving over the loss of a loved one and people might fear for their own safety. And so that was one case that I wrote about in the book, the way in which that murder affected that school community and Boogie's family.
Now, what do you hope this book will do? Who is your ideal reader?
Well, I hope it won't just be read by education wonks and people who are already immersed in education. And that was why I tried to make it sort of very readable and focused on people. I don't really have any delusion that sort of my book will change the minds of people who are extreme ideologues in the debate about charter schools and teachers' unions and school reform. But I hope it will prompt people to think about the issues in a different way. And at the very least, kind of realize that education really isn't about test scores or money or politics, but it really at its heart is about people. And I think it shows sort of the lives at stake in getting it right, and that getting it right involves listening to each other more than most of us typically do, and also trying to understand each other better than we currently do.
And the solutions aren't, they're not going to be simple. They're going to be complex. And I love the way you call for holistic approaches in that. When we think about this, we need to think about it in a really big, big way.
Yeah, no, that was one of the big takeaways for me. As I said earlier, I feel like schools can do a lot on their own, and it's just a crucial part of kind of lifting families out of poverty is improving the schools. But without sort of broader changes throughout all aspects of society, I don't think you're going to see a city revitalized in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking with Sarah Carr, whose important and very moving new book is Hope Against Hope: Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children. Read it, read it, read it. That's all I can say. Sarah Carr discusses in Science Hope Against Hope Thursday, February 28th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Tuesday, March 5th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks for having me on.
Daniel Brook is a journalist whose work has appeared in such publications as Harper's, The Nation, and Slate. He's the author of The Trap: Selling Out to Stay Afloat in Winner-Take-All America. His new book is The History of Future Cities, which is a fascinating look at Dubai, Mumbai, St. Petersburg, and Shanghai. Daniel Brook lives in New Orleans. Dan, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me on.
This book is the amazing story of four cities that parallel each other in a number of different ways. But first and foremost, they were built to resemble other cities.
Yeah, each of the four has this wonderful origin story that just happens to be true, which is that each of them were built essentially out of whole cloth and all built to look like where they weren't. Built to look like somewhere in the West when these cities are all, you know, from Far Eastern Europe all the way to the Far East. St. Petersburg was built to look like Amsterdam, which was Tsar Peter the Great's favorite city after he took a secret incognito trip there in 1697. Shanghai, many Americans don't know this, was initially a colony of the U.S., Britain, and France, and each of the three sections were built to look like the home country. The U.S. section, which you can still visit, although they've changed all the street names, the main avenue is called Broadway, which you may sound familiar. And then Mumbai was a project of the British Empire in India and was built to look like a tropical London. And of course, Dubai is this crazy city that we've all been reading about lately, which people compare to Las Vegas or Houston or some kind of American Sunbelt Fantasia.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
My favorite space in Dubai is the twin Chrysler buildings,
right.
which make you wonder who in Dubai thought if one fake Chrysler building would be good, two would be even better.
Now, these cities share many other qualities. There are differences between natives and immigrants, importance of trade, vast economic differences in the inhabitants, you know, and I was really struck by that image you create in Dubai of those high-rise buildings next to those work camps.
Yeah, each of the cities resembles each other sociologically. They're all cities of immigrants drawing people from all over their region, be it China, India, Russia, or the Arab world, but also from beyond. They all have very odd languages, which is something that New Orleanians can appreciate. In Shanghai, the French spoke French and the English spoke English. In St. Petersburg, as part of their westernization attempt, all the royals and the court spoke French, which was considered very fashionable at that period. Even today in Mumbai and Dubai, they use English. So you get these sort of makeshift societies filled with immigrants that are trying to piece together some kind of functionality. And what you often see is tremendous successes, but also tremendous failures. All of them seem to be plagued by this tremendous wealth disparity that often shakes them to the ground, these sort of towers of Babel.
Yeah, one of the other things I admire about this book is that you explore all these layers of the urban experience, what it takes to create a city. So when you're talking about St. Petersburg, you talk about the museums. When you talk about India, you talk about the railway stations, which I loved. And right down to hotels, sex workers, all kinds of things.
Yeah, I felt like as a civilian, as a non-academic who was intentionally biting off more than anyone could possibly chew, I felt like I had the whole range of the cities to write about. And I tried to pick the most both emblematic and important facets, either in terms of buildings or in terms of society, in each of the cities, and also the most compelling. So the section on 1920s Shanghai focuses on its jazz clubs,
right,
where actually a lot of American and even New Orleans musicians were in residence. Meanwhile, the Bombay section of that era focuses on the movie palaces, which are these spectacular Art Deco buildings that you might find in Los Angeles, California. In fact, one of them was actually built by MGM,
right,
and just plopped down in the middle of Bombay.
And some of the other things you talk about are the world's first museum.
The world's first public museum, yeah, that's the Kunstkammer. It's the St. Petersburg Museum of Science. And it was invented by Peter the Great right after he came back from Western Europe and was despondent at how far the Westerners had surpassed Russians in their scientific knowledge. When he was in Holland, he visited Anton van Leeuwenhoek, the inventor of the microscope. He went to lectures on anatomy by the top doctors of the time. And when he comes back to St. Petersburg, he builds both a university to educate formally the elite, both men and women, which, again, is a huge sort of
right,
future city type of thing. In the West, at that point, higher education was generally for men only. And also this first public museum where you can see, for example, a fetus in a glass jar.
Right.
Trying to explain to people who, you know, historically had believed in all sorts of superstitions and church-oriented reasons about the mystery of human life, you know, where babies come from.
And writing this book must have been a dream of travel, really. How much time did you spend in all these places?
Yeah, some people joke, I only pick my writing subjects by places I want to go. I spent 1 month in each of the cities, and what I was doing there was talking to architects who are practicing in the city today, talking to urban planners who are planning the city today, visiting the buildings that I end up writing about, both historic and contemporary. And then as the book took shape, the palette from which I drew could be walking down the street in Nanjing Road in Shanghai or interviewing a contemporary architect in Shanghai, or it could also be interviewing a history professor in Shanghai who could tell me about Shanghai in the 20s, or seeing the buildings in Shanghai today that were built in the 20s. So it all ends up drawing on, I hope, into a cohesive narrative that's actually pulled from all these different strands together.
Well, it's such a surprising and wonderful book. I mean, there's this wonderful evocative title, The History of Future Cities, but the writing is so insightful and poetic. I felt like I'd been on a fabulous vacation.
I'm really touched to hear that. I mean, my ideal reader has been to one of these cities, maybe two. But to explain to people who've never been there why I'm so captivated by them and also why they matter, one thing that's interesting is in reading historic sources about these cities, it's always, there's this amazing city in India that's nothing like India. So these cities were always fascinating because they were so different. And now, I was just in Bangalore, actually, last month. I was there at the opening of India's first Krispy Kreme donut shop, which there's a red
that's
carpet
great.
And a security guard. I have a great photo
Very
of
cool.
it. But my idea is that, you know, Mumbai used to be exciting because it was so unusual. Now it's so normal that these little snippets of the Western world are getting dropped down all over the developing world now. So all of a sudden, these cities that used to be fascinating because they were different are important because they're so similar.
Exactly. Well, it's just a fascinating book. And you can meet Daniel Brook when he discusses and signs The History of Future Cities Thursday, February 28th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. And he'll also be appearing at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival March 20th through 24th. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Veronica Kvas is an art curator and writer who lives in her hometown of Nashville. Her first book was The Last Good War, Faces and Voices of World War II. In a real change of subject, her new book is Artist in Love, From Picasso and Gillo to Christo and Jean-Claude, A Century of Creative and Romantic Partnerships. We're happy to welcome her back to New Orleans, where she studied at Loyola University. Hi, Veronica. I'm so happy to meet you.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
I love this book. It's so inspiring and thought-provoking, and there's so much beautiful art and so many interesting couples. Tell us about the original idea for this project.
Well, the idea started basically over a casual conversation with the editor of the book. I had worked on another book for her, The Last Good War, and she had always wanted to do a book like Artists in Love forever. So in getting to know me, she learned that I love art. I've worked with art and artists. And I especially have an interest in the intersection between work and life. So she thought I'd be the perfect person to do this book. And I tested it out and wrote little stories. And that's how it all came about.
Well, and you had to settle on 29 couples. That must have been very hard.
It was. We wanted to do a certain number of couples. And in the process of image permission and everything, we lost them along the way. It's kind of hard to pull something like this all together.
So much of this book is about love, and you don't shy away from the provocative image. You start off with Lee Miller in that collar, and then the cover image is Jean-Claude wrapped to perfection by Christo. What were you thinking when you chose those images?
Well, I do believe those images capture the element of this book that is a little different from maybe the rest of the work that those artists have done. It offers a glimpse into their romantic lives, the partners they had, and how they inspired one another. And they are provocative images, but that's a big part of this whole story, is that element of their lives. So I think that the images sort of speak for themselves. They immediately tell you that this book is going to take you into that realm of their lives.
And you sound so captivated by Lee Miller, as I am.
Yes. She was the cornerstone for this. When the editor told me she wanted to do this book, the first person I thought of was Lee Miller.
I can really see why. Now, one of the things that comes home to the reader is that we never really know the truth about what goes on between two people. There's only so much we can know. And when you write about Frida Kahlo being obsessed by Diego Rivera's physique, Well, for many people, that will be a mystery. But the creative spark of his genius and their attraction is never in doubt.
Yeah, it's definitely the attraction here for, I think, all of the partners that are represented was centered around the work that they were doing. So the attraction started with the talent. Kahlo was drawn to him because he was this big artist at the time doing murals, and she loved his work. So the fact that he was this enormous, monstrous man, it didn't even seem to matter. And that happens throughout. These relationships are not shallow. They are very deep and involved in the artwork that's being made by partners themselves.
And intellectual and instinctual.
Oh, yeah.
So much. So many layers of relationship. And you also include two gay couples.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish there were more. Rauschenberg and Johns. People know about it, but there isn't that much material on it. So this is pretty exciting to be able to represent them in this context, whereas most books don't. And we have a photograph of them when they were a couple. And the same goes for McDermott and McGough, although their relationship, they started making work a generation after Rauschenberg and Johns. They were able to just be openly gay. So those are two different types, whereas Johns and Rauschenberg were pretty much in the closet during their relationship.
And that photograph of them, their relationship seems so tender.
Yeah, this is the best photograph. I mean, it's one of my favorites in the book. The photographer really managed to capture this moment. So much of their relationship involved the two of them spending time in their studios talking to one another about their work. And their studios were right on top of each other, so bits of one artist's work would end up in layers of the other's artist's work. And this is what they did. They would sit around and talk about their work all the time.
And, of course, one of the great American romances is George O'Keefe and Alfred Stieglitz.
Yes, that is a well-documented romance. Stieglitz was so inspired by O'Keefe that he did a whole series of photographs about her. It's over 200 photographs, and the series is called Study of O'Keefe. So he was pretty obsessed with her, and that was obvious in that body of work. She became a muse that she became an artist in her own right, too. And her work was quite separate from his once she started taking it out into the desert.
And then one of the others, and this wasn't as familiar to me, one of the other couples who lives in the Great Southwest is Bruce Nauman and Susan Rothenberg.
Yes, they're an interesting couple. I am a big, big fan of Nauman. And Rothenberg, I didn't know as well, but I also like her work a lot. It was interesting to think about going into Nauman's life and learning about his romantic side of his life, because his work, which is conceptual, is kind of dark, and when you're experiencing his work, you don't really think about what he's like as a significant other. So to go in and explore that, that was interesting. There isn't a whole lot there to find, but I definitely found some really good pieces that revealed what their relationship was like.
I love it when Susan Rothenberg says, "I don't think I'll ever know Bruce, but he's mine, and he's a beauty."
Yes. That line, I remember when I read that line the first time, I was like, that's it, that's perfect. He's definitely a mysterious person.
And lastly, one of the relationships that's so fascinating to me is that of Marina Abramović and Ule. And I remember seeing that film of The Artist is Present and thinking, what an act of trust and stubborn love it was for them to stand naked opposite each other in that doorway and expect museum visitors to squeeze through so they could pass between them.
Exactly. I think that really captures what their relationship was like, that they were definitely the type of couple that, on one hand, they're performers, so they definitely are catering to the audience. And then on the other hand, they seem to not even care or be aware of the audience and put themselves in these uncomfortable positions that really prove that they could just sort of zero in on one another and lose sight of everyone else in these really long performances. And I'm really glad that they're in the book.
Oh, wow. Me too. Well, there's so much to think about in this beautiful, beautiful book. You can meet Veronica Kvas, author of Artist in Love, Monday, March 4th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Or you can hear her read Tuesday, March 5th at 7 p.m. at the Columns Hotel as part of the 1718 reading series. Thank you so much, Veronica.
Thank you so much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Elsa Hahn signs The Gravy in the Kitchen with New Orleans Musicians, Tuesday, February 26th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Economist Michael Schumann signs Local Dollars, Local Cents, How to Shift Your Money from Wall Street to Main Street and Achieve Real Prosperity, Tuesday, February 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Laura Weiss, author of Ice Cream, A Global History, appears Wednesday, February 27th from 5 to 7 at the Creole Creamery, 4924 Britannia. The Big Read is a program of the National Endowment for the Arts designed to revitalize the role of literary reading in American popular culture. Xavier University, as a Big Read grant recipient, has chosen as their book, Ernest Gaines, A Lesson Before Dying. Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street will hold a book discussion of that book Wednesday, February 27th at 6. Today's guest, Sarah Carr, signs Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children, Thursday, February 28th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Tuesday, March 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Daniel Brook, signs A History of Future Cities, Thursday, February 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Chris Wilt signs Shoot the Money, Thursday, February 28th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. John McCusker signs Creole Trombone, Kid Ory in the Early Years of Jazz, Thursday, February 28th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Poet Jericho Brown reads Thursday, February 28th at 7 at the Stone Auditorium at Tulane University. Poets Barbara Henning and Jamie Jones read Thursday, February 28th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Deirdre Gogarty and Darylin Saloom sign My Call to the Ring, a memoir of a girl who learns to box, Friday, March 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Fiction Writers Group holds a critique session Monday, March 4th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Veronica Kvass, signs Artists in Love, From Picasso and Gillot to Christo and Jean-Claude, A Century of Creative and Romantic Partnerships, Monday, March 4th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. She also appears as part of the 1718 reading series, Tuesday, March 5th at 7 at the Collins Hotel. The Black Widow Literary Salon features Liz Williams, founder and director of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and author of New Orleans, A Food Biography, and Sarah Rowan, author of Gumbo Tales, Monday, March 4th at 7 at Crescent City Books. N.S. Patrick discusses and signs The Mysteries of Jack the Ripper, Tuesday, March 5th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And coming up, the Loyola Writing Institute offers three spring courses starting March 4th. Platitudes of Truth, Writing Creative Nonfiction with Peyton Burgess, Writing Well-Crafted Fiction with Stephen Ray, Writing Your Life, Memoirs and Family History with Patricia Brady, and Poetry, Manuscript, Editing and Conceptualizing with Joseph Makos. To register, call 504-931-9902 or check out loino.edu/wpc/loyola-writing-institute. New Orleans Museum of Art and Cafe Noma by Ralph Brennan are celebrating Edible Book Day, a cake baking and decorating contest. That's at Noma on Friday, April 5th. Design, bake, and decorate a cake inspired by your favorite book and bring it to Noma on Friday, April 5th to be judged by a panel of celebrity judges. No fee to enter. Categories include funniest, punniest, best visual presentation, most creative, most like a book, and special professional categories for those who bake for a living. For more information, contact Sheila Cork, librarian at the New Orleans Museum of Art at scork@noma.org or call 504-658-4117. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.